Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Symmetry of Souls' weekly two-hour study of the Urantia Papers. We're seeking to grasp the fifth epical revelation in a synthetic wholeness. Tonight, paper 124, section 2, paragraph 4. It's our arc, Jesus of Nazareth. The master was so changed that they did not yet recognize him with his back turned to the dim light. And as they pondered his words, he addressed Mary Magdalene with a familiar voice, saying, "Mary." And she knelt at his feet and exclaimed, "My Lord and my Master." That is from paper 189, The Resurrection, and I was going to read it last week in celebration of Easter just having ended, but we're going to defer it here, and there it is. That's the other bookend of Jesus' life just after his mortal life ended. But we're back in Jesus' childhood here, and I'm Brad Garner. So glad that you're here with us live or in our archive at symmetryofsoul.org. It's Dr. Chris Halverson, David Tucker, Justin Armstrong, and you here with us tonight. Won't you call up the text of the Urantia Papers as you see fit and settle in for about 1% of your week and consecrate it here. Hello there, Dr. Chris.
Hello, Brad. Thank you, as always. Hello to you, Justin and Dave. And everyone has joined us finally after our little unplanned off week last week, but we're back and rolling here. Probably ought to just comment since you, like you said, you're going to read that last week, but here you are reading it on a day where the calendar says April 9th. we've been talking about the whole issue with the Julian calendar and the Gregorian calendar here in this arc, because we pass through that BC to AD transition in the Revelation. And it's worth reminding everyone that when the Revelators say the resurrection was on April 9, that is April 9 in the Julian calendar, which is offset by 2 days with the Gregorian calendar, which is the one that you have on your wall, offset by 2 days. So the actual anniversary, in our calendar, in the Gregorian calendar, for that resurrection is April 7. So a couple days ago was the actual anniversary in terms of how many times the earth has gone around the sun of the resurrection. And all these AD dates that you read through, have that 2 day offset in terms of what they actually were in our Gregorian calendar, extended back to overlap with Jesus' life. But that little technical detail yet again emphasized aside. We have some more vignettes of Jesus' young life to step through here. We're going to start off with one of the most famous ones here in the first paragraph we read tonight, and maybe I'll put in my 2 cents up front to remind everyone we will be off the next 2 Tuesdays. And then we'll be back in the saddle again at the end of the month here in April. We will have a show on the 30th of April, but we will have the 16th and the 23rd off. So everyone make a note of that, and we'll come back around on the 30th.
All right. Thank you for that, Chris. Yes, we'll be off for a couple of weeks here on our Tuesday evening show, but our companion Friday podcast will continue. We'll be exploring some other themes, not directly related, but tangential to what we're currently reading here. So continue to tune in on Fridays when new episodes are available. You can see that at symmetryofsoul.org. All right. And a good evening to you, David. How are you doing, sir?
Oh, hello, Brad. I'm doing just fine, having myself a great week, a little spring break, and I'm busying myself with setting a guard upon my natural proclivity towards being overly vain.
Sounds like something that may come up tonight. But I'm far more intrigued. I guess I didn't get the memo. So when you have kids, like you're given spring break again as an adult. That's really cool. That's something to look forward to.
Yeah,
can't wait to tell my
cool employer.
I've
taken a few units in college right now, so that's a nice little break. And I'm really
excited. That's right. Exactly. Yeah. No, I'm pretty sure that once you have kids around, the fact they're having spring break cannot be ignored in the household, too. So, all right. And Justin, good evening to you, sir. Glad that you're here. And, gosh, you'll really have to help remind us what we were up to a couple of weeks ago. What was that?
Good evening, Brad. Good evening, Dr. Chris. And good evening, David. Yes, I have a review here for everyone. And since we're taking 2 weeks off and we missed last week, I also have a special riddle at the end of the review for anyone that wants to call in with the answer. But let's start with the review here. As a child, Jesus achieved a genuine faith grasp through developing a recognition of spirit values. His worship urge was directed by a wisdom that was centered upon a spirit nucleus. It is only after the establishment of a religious nature that he attempted to sharpen this innate insight of his mind. There is a sequence that starts with spirit values that are founded upon a faith nucleus, a sequence in which we must seek first the kingdom of heaven by establishing an unquestioning loyalty to the Father's will. Once this religious foundation is centered and established, the never-ending experiential journey of sharpening a greater philosophical attainment begins through a wholehearted devotion to supreme values. We read in paper 98, section 2, the following. Religions have long endured without philosophical support, but few philosophies as such have long persisted without some identification with religion. Regarding the temperamental balance passed down to Jesus from his parents concerning religious and philosophical domains, consider the following passage in paper 122, section 5. Joseph held vigorously to the Eastern or Babylonian views of the Jewish religion. Mary leaned strongly towards the more liberal and broader Western or Hellenistic interpretation of the law and the prophets. Personality is in total control of how our mind is framed. Consider the geometric consequences to exercising your will. There is a holistic influence regarding inner creativity contributing to the ennoblement of character through personality integration and selfhood unification. There is also the potential for destructivity in the inner life. Our concept frame of preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and long-standing prejudices control every thought we have and encompasses our mind in a holistic way. We read in paper 111, section 4, since this inner life of man is truly creative, there rests upon each person the responsibility of choosing as to whether this creativity shall be spontaneous and wholly haphazard, or controlled, directed, and constructive. How can a creative imagination produce worthy children when the stage whereon it functions is already preoccupied by prejudice, hate, fears, resentments, revenge, and bigotries? The volitional absolute has handed over full sovereignty of the inner life to you alone. May you find eternal guidance by seeking a personal realization of divine fellowship with the Universal Father. We began our reading in paper 124, section 0, The Later Childhood of Jesus. In reflecting on the second developmental stage of the later childhood of Jesus, approximately ages 8 through 12, we notice that his environment consists of both diversity and stability. His education at Nazareth encompassed a balanced approach to the relative merits of both Eastern and Western views of Hebrew theology. His religious guidance was tempered by a Hellenic philosophical influence. Paper 124, section 1, Jesus' ninth year AD 3. In late winter, Jesus dared to challenge the teaching that all images, pictures, and drawings were idolatrous in nature when he was discovered to be drawing a charcoal picture of the teacher on the floor of the schoolroom. Many of the elders approached Joseph regarding the lawless nature of this incident. Jesus resented the elders blaming his father for his alleged misdeeds, and he courageously defended his viewpoint while also declaring that he would abide by his father in this, as in all other matters controversial. Joseph felt impelled to rule that the rabbinical interpretation of the second commandment should prevail, and although Jesus was unconvinced of the wrong of what he had done, he followed his father's instructions. The young Jesus demonstrated faith in following the instructions of the fifth commandment and honoring his father and mother. Shortly thereafter, he observed his father's faith in following the instructions of the second commandment. The father's way was presented to the early races during the first epical revelation. Melchizedek patterned seven commandments after the ancient Dalmatian supreme law, and the Ten Commandments, which Moses promulgated in the name of Yahweh, were predicated on the teachings of Melchizedek. The Father's way was revealed to mankind over 500,000 years ago, and we must strive to manifest a living faith by believing in God's promises and following his instructions. In following these instructions into his adulthood, Jesus eventually taught that man's whole duty is summed up in this one commandment: love the Lord your God with all your mind and soul, and your neighbor as yourself. In the spirit of this one commandment, we must also recognize that faith is not merely the acceptance of a pre-constructed dogma. It is the living and dynamic mode in which a person develops a realization of divine fellowship with the presence of God in the inner life. Paper 124, Section 2, the 10th year, AD 4. As a humble child on earth, the young Jesus developed a moral consciousness in realizing that his values were being translated from the material to the spiritual, from the human to the divine, from time to eternity. This awakening to the picturizations of destiny in the evolving consciousness of Jesus gave expression to feelings and ideas which indicated that he was becoming self-conscious of the unusual nature of his life mission. Both Joseph and Mary listened attentively to the momentous words of their son, but volunteered no information in response. It was almost 2 years before Jesus again spoke to his parents concerning this increasing revelation within his own consciousness regarding the nature of his personality and the character of his mission on earth. And there ends the review.
Terrific.
Nice job.
Wow, thank you. Yeah, thank you, Justin. As always, I appreciate your pacing and your word choice, word selection. So well done there. And you also brought back to mind some of those vivid images we studied a couple of weeks ago about Jesus there in the schoolroom with the committee of elders, doing what committees do, committeeing, making their ruling. And that led to some very helpful discussion on our Friday podcast, but that's not what this is about. Curious if anyone has anything to add, clarifications, thoughts that brings back to mind.
I think one of those midi things is turning nouns into verbs like that.
that does happen.
One little point, if I've heard you correctly, when you're talking about the developmental stages or phases, I think you said second, and you know it's third because the developmental stages after birth, you know, the first one is 0 up to 3, and then the second one is 3 up to 8, and then the third one is 8 up to 12.
I did misspeak there, so thank you for clarifying that. That makes sense.
And one little point of technicality here, Justin. I noticed in paper 124, section 2, where you said the 10th year, AD 4, I didn't notice a day of the week That was a company you find out. Just trying to get everything consistent here with
it. That's right.
Great job, though, yeah. Justin. I love reading it.
Commenting on that. We'll see it again tonight. It becomes, almost, comical. You can't help but kind of smile a little bit. Now, every time you read one of the latter siblings, when they give the day of the week, and it's just, there it is. It's so glaring once you point it out. It's like, how come those first two don't have days of the week? Yes.
Yeah, I'm a little upset that I happened to realityize that thing you gave me, Chris, and some of the bigger, more important ones haven't really sunk in yet, but I'm just sticking with it,
Well, I suppose, we can start pedantically and see if we can work our way up. We'll strain at gnats to start with.
I do have something fun, since we're going to be off for 2 weeks, for anyone who's out there listening that might want to call in today. It's a really short riddle that I want to share. The answer is one word. If no one calls in, then feel free, the three of you, to answer this. But I'm going to share it now, so if anyone wants to call in, we would appreciate that. And here is the riddle. What can be seen but is found, what cannot be seen, but is found within sight, can be known, but is not a knowledge that can be given.
Oh, tantalizing. All right, I'll put that into my subconscious boiler and see what it comes up with here in the next little bit. Took a note. All right. One thought that I had, I wonder if any of us are biblically versed enough, Chris, to help out with
probably
this.
Not.
But since we were talking about commandments, I'm finding as I'm getting into the Bible, I get confused when I see things repeated, and they get repeated a fair bit. Like the Ten Commandments show up in the Bible in at least a couple of spots, and I'm trying to figure out, like, there's this list of Ten Commandments that's from Exodus 34 that does not sound like Dalmatia. Like, the list is all about blood sacrifices and unleavened bread and seething kids in mother's milk. And it seems like the Israelites, like, got really off track, and Moses then came along and said, those ten are cool and all, but here's a better ten. I mean, am I correct that there was this list of ten that was basically all just incredibly materially oriented codifications of their ritual lives, but that those don't apply by the time of Jesus?
Yeah. If you go back and look, the revelators talk about that issue that you had. You had those very old school taboo issues that were definitely in need of refocusing to the commandments coming down from Dalmatia through Adam and Eve, through Melchizedek. That I can't remember exactly where that is, but the relators address that issue, right, of those other commandments. Not to mention the Hebrews and then the Jews, coming down to today, still have a tendency to put a lot of emphasis beyond the ten. They strain at gnats, as we were just saying before, and go through every word of the Hebrew Scriptures, and give you a vast pile of hundreds of commandments.
Is this the oral law in those, 613 or some number like that?
Right, yeah.
Along those lines? Yeah.
Yeah, he's taking all those you know, little minutiae of details, right? And struggling, you know, still to this day, to things in more of a hierarchical sensibility. You know, see, that's why Jesus, you know, even, you know, 2,000 years ago was trying to help them with that, by, you know, listing up, you know, a commandment to stand above all others. You know, and even when you look at the Ten Commandments, you know, that come out with Jesus and Gannett, you know, assembling the teachings of the religions in paper 131, you know, you see there that, you know, that you combine one and two together as two. You know, you don't separate out the specifics of the graven image, you know, issues. And then you put the first commandment, you shall love me with all your heart. You know, so, you know, just the constant need to try to lift the flatlanders out of the plain, you know, where they want to just pool down into hundreds of commandments down in the plain there, you know, right, and cease to have any upward sensibility in their minds, you know, that can lift, you know, at least, you know, 10 up and then maybe put a cherry on the top of the 10.
That does seem to be our tendency. I mean, it's tricky because there is a pattern in the cosmos that as things get downstepped, they can kind of fracture, you know, from one mind into a sevenfold mind. Like there is a complexity that happens as you downstep, but that does not mean that, you know, that the living way is crystallizing into set formulas that never change.
This is summed up nicely in 99.1, where they state, the spirit of religion is eternal, but the form of its expression must be restated every time the dictionary of human language is revised.
Yeah
and the living
Jesus. This tendency to just, you know, start proliferating, you know, and getting into ever minuter details. You know, we see that, you know, in the growing secular totalitarianism that, you know, the revelation is, you know, in large part here to challenge. You know, that, you know, it starts out with, you know, with big issues that, you know, maybe you can get a lot of people to kind of buy in. It's like, well, yeah, that's a worthy thing. Let's all go with that. Treat that as kind of a cultural commandment. You know, but then comes another one, and then another one, and then another one, and they get, you know, down into minuter and minuter details until the next thing you know, you're just, you know, in utter tyranny. You know, where they're trying to, you know, have a commandment for every, you know, jot and tittle of your life.
You know, I have a question along these lines.
Justin, could you maybe hold it for a second? We do have a
sure.
caller. I want to see if they want to either answer your riddle or tag on to what we were saying there. But
okay.
Please
okay.
do take a note there. Here we go. 562, you're on the air.
Hey, good evening. This is Winston. The riddle. Can I just hear the ending part of it again?
Sure
what,
thing.
The knowledge that
what,
could be given?
Yeah, what cannot be seen
mm-hmm.
but is found within sight can be known but is not a knowledge that can be given.
I thought it was value.
I thought it was intuition.
I was going to say recognition.
But it's probably something, you know, really obvious, like, I don't know, like a stepladder, or something really rote. I don't know. Something obscure.
Okay.
I'll tell you what, while you're on the line, Winston, I'll give you one clue. I'll phrase the beginning differently so I'm not being so tricky. What cannot be seen but is found with insight can be known, but is not a knowledge that can be given.
Gosh, I'll pass. Thank you.
Thank you for calling, Winston.
Okay. Thanks, Winston.
Thanks, Winston. Good to hear your voice. All right.
Okay, my question.
Justin, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, when I was reflecting on the Ten Commandments this morning, actually, and I was thinking about how the first five have this sort of upper hemisphere in how they're focused in some ways on God, even that fifth commandment of obey your father and mother. There's, you could think of that in the context of the universal father ultimately, and what you're trying, the spirit of what that's focused on. But the second five, 6 through 10, seem much more directed in this sort of lower hemisphere mode in terms of laws that we still have in place today regarding murder and stealing and whatnot. And I was wondering, my question is that those two hemispheres that apply to the Ten Commandments, is there something that's worth looking at in regards to the original seven that has that same quality, or Melchizedek's seven, where there's like kind of an upper hemisphere quality and a lower hemisphere quality to the fullness of the list?
Well, first of all, as I pointed out in my, my little study in the Perfecting Arises Library about the Ten Commandments, and you can see Jesus reinforcing this in the Revelation. To think of the Ten Commandments as four and then six.
Oh, interesting.
Okay, and then when you, as you're pointing out, when you look at the six, 5 through 10, you can see that 5 through 9 are from the, directly from the original seven commandments. Right, and 10 has been added on. And then noticing that you've got those five commandments, 5 through 9. See, those those are the latter ones of the original seven, and with the seven you have two and then five.
Okay.
So the seven, you have two and then five. With the Ten Commandments, you have four and then six. Right? You have these two subsets. Right? You've got the ones that are establishing the sort of the kind of an overall predicate, especially with the seven commandments. And then the details, under that. The other thing you can notice, if you actually look at the Ten Commandments, the two times that they're listed out in the Hebrew Scriptures, in Exodus and in Deuteronomy, in both cases, it's very obvious how that Hebrew mind, that became the Jewish mind. The way it tends to be very wordy, it stands out clearly. The commandments that they very definitively have added to the original seven. Because instead of being a pithy little sentence, there's word after word after word after sentence after sentence, great big long exhaustive thing,
right.
Or if it's not super long, it's highly enumerated, like the Hebrews love to list things. So you can very much see how it's basically the seven, with some obvious additions, and a little bit of cultural shifting. But again, to just notice that you always have to establish the basis for the commandments, like with the original seven, that's the first two. And then you give some specifics. So just kind of think of it, in that mode, right? That you have the very kind of framing issues in the Ten Commandments of 1 through 4, and then some specifics within that frame for the remainder.
For those who are interested, there is a page on symmetryofsoul.org called Commandments. You can search for it. It's just a little compilation where we've put some of this information together. By we, I mean me. So I'm accountable for what I screwed up, messed up there or didn't get right. But one thing I tried to do was in parentheses after Moses's, the Mosaic commandments, I put in parentheses which Dalmatian commandments they seem to associate with, and at least my interpretation of it. And it's more or less, it's matching what Chris is pointing out. So might help your study. It's a little expounding upon all the commandments, including Jesus's new commandment, and including even one that's kind of a commandment for the Andonites before the first epical revelation. It's just the golden rule, but not a commandment. It's just a thing. Let's see.
Finish your thought, Brad. I'm sorry.
Oh, I just wanted to make a joke and say, in defense of numbered lists, the Urantia book, by my count, has 406 numbered lists in it. So our revelators are really into them, too. It's not just Hebrews.
Yeah, it's one thing to have a list like in the Revelation. It's another where, you instead of saying, the stuff in the cupboard, you actually list out, every single item of, all 100 items in the cupboard.
Finely twisted linen. Yeah, finely twisted linen. Yeah, it's always...
Did I need to have all those details, guys?
That's right.
But it's, that's one of the delightful things about, where you can tell it's a more ancient consciousness. It's more childlike. When you go back into more ancient times, and it's and of course religion will tend to set that mentality in stone and carry it forward, which is another reason why you have the if you set aside the emergency issue of the fifth epical revelation, that issue of trying to foster religion as the philosophic attainment, to try to liberate that little frozen nugget, that can literally be not someone's childlike mind of today, but literally someone parroting the childlike mind of thousands of years ago. Right? And these frozen forms that religious dogma and sacred texts, perpetuates.
Yeah. Yeah, I was
to try to liberate that, liquefy that frozen form, and then allow philosophic growth upon that now living nucleus.
Right. Yeah, it is a tricky thing. I mean, Jesus tried to cover this with the apostles. This astonishing growth of the God concept that if you read the scriptures chronologically, you can see it. But I was just the other day looking at what is otherwise an outstanding little devotional on the really big Bible app available on any smart device worldwide. It's called Introduction to the Christian Faith. It's a nine-day reading plan. But doggone it, on day two, they go right to Exodus 34, where it says, God does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children and their children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation. So there you are trying to understand the Christian faith, and you're right off to the races reading about third and fourth generation punishment stuff. And then, then meanwhile, more evolved religions trying to talk about, individual accountability before God and your own choices. So it's very confusing if you don't read the scriptures in an evolutionary fashion.
Yeah. And of course, you have to read them factually and kind of officially, the immediate appearance of them in an evolutionary fashion, but there's a reason why even the most primitive forms are in the text, because there's a truth that transcends time. you know, that can be recognized through even that those primitive forms.
Oh, sure.
The truth of eternity,
passage.
You know, if we could foster more of a recognition of the truths, but that requires human eyes, and especially skeptics engaging, say, the Bible, right? That's not technically, well, technically they're human, but they're not effectively a human when they're looking at it, right? So they know not the truth. And they just see it in this very superficial fashion. And they're sophisticated intellectually enough, to see the juvenile presentation and dismiss it, as if you can know the book by its cover.
Right. Right. Yeah, in fairness, that very same passage also lays out that the Lord our God is abounding in love and faithfulness. He forgives wickedness, rebellion, and sin, and he does not let the guilty go unpunished. Like, it is getting the mercy and justice aspects beautifully, and this is like 3,000 years old. So that's very much there. It's just if you're trying to understand the entire passage, you'll see some things that factually could throw you off if you're a new reader. But you're right, there's a truth flowing through these which makes them enduring. I agree.
Yeah. I mean, it's always so pitiful to see someone who technically could approach the Bible, with a measure of recognition, but has chosen to circumscribe their mind, so that it can't know truth, and can't see it when it's right there between the lines of what they're reading. Right? A human can recognize the transcendent character of something, even if it's in a limited package. But again, it's just we've lost that humility of teachability, as we've gotten more intellectually sophisticated. And speaking of teachability, that will actually come up as we start reading tonight if we want to get into the reading.
Yeah, let's get into it. Although I will pause and say we have, Justin, two candidate answers in our live chat room. One of them is reality, and the other one is truth. Are we any closer?
Yeah, Chris was giving a lot of hints in the last 5 minutes or so with sight and insight. And yes, truth is the correct answer. Ding, 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 ding. Congratulations.
Ding, 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 ding. Congratulations
I was tempted to say if I were to reword Justin's final line and saying it's a but it's not a knowingness that can be given, would that get people's recognition going?
You're just a hop, skip, and a search away then, yeah.
Because, of course, technically, the ledge part of knowledge is the giving part. So it's not a knowingness that can be given. It's repetitious to say it. It's a knowledge that can be given. Anyway, it's truth. But what is truth? Again, as I was pointing out, this is as Justin was in the riddle there, it's nothing that's immediately apparent. It certainly is not recognizable at all with the eyes that you were born with. One has to transcend one's birth for there to be even the slightest hint of the reality of truth, in your consciousness. And so, we come back to this, the oft-repeated request of those who are would like to be or think of themselves as being students of the revelation. Remember that what you're seeking can't be seen.
Yeah.
Right? And in the same way that, you don't want to judge a book by its cover, quote unquote, like I was saying a minute ago. You can't know the truth by the words that you read in the revelation. The words are just words. Words can be parsed and played with by a machine, as we're beginning to, demonstrate quite profoundly these days. Right? You can program a machine to parse all the words, in existence and play with them, write poems with them and whatnot.
Sure, yeah.
Okay. But no matter, how fancy the poetry or play or novel or whatever that computer writes, it can't know truth. Right? And so, rather than thinking, machines are now so much more sophisticated, than a human could ever be, there's nothing left for me. Yeah, there's nothing left for you in the expanse of the plane, but why don't you go up? Because that computer can't go up. It's stuck in the plane.
Adding machine down in the plane, that's right.
Just a fancy assimilating mechanism of Flatlander stuff.
Yeah, there's no spiritualized mind. There's no inner life. There's no personality or a pattern influence applied to that spirit energy. It's just a machine.
There's, and the degree, again, the fact that we have such sophisticated machines now, can possibly try to challenge humans to figure out what the difference is between creativity and inventiveness.
Yes.
When they see, those machines, quote unquote, creating all kinds of stuff, it's like, no, that's impossible. It can't create anything by definition. All it's doing is inventing. It's clever. What exactly is it, does it mean to be originative, to be creative? What does it look like when you do something that machine can't do?
You're purposing spirit, substance. That's a very different...
Can you produce art that it can't? Can you produce a novel that it can't?
Right. I think it's a fine time to be alive and ask those questions, but don't short-circuit them and say, throw in the towel, machines are better than humans now. That's not a great answer. I think we can find a better definition of human through the challenges we're facing sociologically these days, if we will.
And initially, people are going to try to find their humanity, in the gaps that the current computer systems leave. It's like, I can add a little bit of filigree in this little gap here that it hasn't produced. It's like, they're going to make the machine more sophisticated until, it can add filigree within filigree and until there's no spots left in the plane for you to draw.
Yeah.
Then what?
You got to go up. Yeah. All right, well, let's get on with the reading back to a time when they didn't have chatbots roaming the digital landscape and in their pockets. It was a simpler time, but it was a fine time to raise children. We are in paper 124 of the Urantia Papers, The Later Childhood of Jesus. We're in section 2, continuing our reading. That section is the 10th year, AD 4, and AD 4. And we're starting at paragraph 4, which is on page 1368 of the original printing of these in the single column format. And we're talking about Jesus here, of course. Perhaps his most unusual and outstanding trait was his unwillingness to fight for his rights. Since he was such a well-developed lad for his age, it seemed strange to his playfellows that he was disinclined to defend himself even from injustice or when subjected to personal abuse. As it happened, he did not suffer much on account of this trait because of the friendship of Jacob, a neighbor boy, who was 1 year older. He was the son of the stonemason, a business associate of Joseph. Jacob was a great admirer of Jesus and made it his business to see that no one was permitted to impose upon Jesus because of his aversion to physical combat. Several times, older and uncouth youths attacked Jesus, relying upon his reputed docility, but they always suffered swift and certain retribution at the hands of his self-appointed champion and ever-ready defender, Jacob, the stonemason's son.
Yeah, there he is, Jacob, the stonemason's son. Let's think about some of the issues that lie beyond the immediacy of this oft-read paragraph, very famous paragraph to longtime readers about Jacob, the stonemason's son. So first of all, think about the apparent supremacy that's in play here. That Gabriel picks Mary and Joseph for these biologic parents, and all of the mysteries of what DNA ends up going into Jesus, for Mary and Joseph's first conception. He's born, he begins to be raised, and he's manifesting a biologic temperament that is unwilling to fight for his rights, as they say there. This is kind of an interesting little quote-unquote coincidence. Because after all, when all is said and done with this incarnation, both before and after the baptism, he is choosing to manifest the Father's will. Very much so to produce a manifestation that helps to clarify what part of the grand scheme of things the Universal Father right. is the immediate predicate for. Of all the things in play, the Universal Father is not the immediate predicate to this administration.
Right.
And so, because little biologic Jesus has this temperament, right, he's not initially inclined, and then subsequently becomes more of an issue of his conscious will, he's not inclined to manifest justice administration. And, that fact did come out, from the apostles, to modern times, but it has gotten quite twisted, to the point where many have totally set aside the notion of justice administration.
Right. Don't judge.
Yeah.
Never judge
even,
anywhere, at any place, any time.
Minister justice, right, yeah.
Right.
And so this is a very important paragraph. Yes, Jesus directly wasn't the agent of justice administration, but there was an agent of justice administration. Jacob, the stone Mason's son, gets to play the Trinity while Jesus is playing the Father. Right? And the Justice Administration of the Trinity downstepped and manifest for the world to observe in Jacob the Stonemason's son is swift and sure.
Yeah. Like a terrible swift sword, yeah.
Suffered swift and certain retribution.
You know, I had a reflection on this first sentence as well. Perhaps his most unusual and outstanding trait was his unwillingness to fight for his rights. And later on in the paragraph when they talk about this reputed docility, you have in the Creator's Son, the original material sons in Satania, they're the direct offspring of Michael, and they're patterned after beings from one Havona world. And this Adam and Eve who came to Urantia were descended from this original Satania pair of material sons. And there's a reference where in 124:2 where they say the Adamites were pacific, the Nodites were belligerent. So Jesus is taking on that pacific nature in the flesh, and it's unusual for his culture because his character was embracing an Adamite quality while his biological nature had just a small fraction of that biological uplift. So I kind of found that interesting, that its pacific nature is found in the that which is coming down to uplift. And then Jesus
And again, of course, one needs to parse all this carefully and not blur all this together, because Jesus is not a pacifist.
Sure.
Right? Just the immediacy here, right, is to, you know, I mean, before you get into all the details like that, you know, the important thing that the midwayers are clearing up is that Jesus didn't reveal that there is no justice administration, as many have come to believe. Right? And then you can just do whatever you want because God loves us infinitely and absolutely. You're fine. No. Every human will always suffer swift and certain retribution for their sin.
One other really quick point, and this is regarding institutional religion, not necessarily the religionist as manifest in the child of Jesus, but there's the statement, its only proper attitude consists in the teaching of nonviolence, the doctrine of peaceful evolution in the place of violent revolution, peace on earth, and goodwill among men. Of course, that reference is in regards to institutional religion, just to make that clear, but they're still sort of hinting in this direction of peace, the Prince of Peace.
But it's just so important that when we start talking about love and peace, that we do
plan,
so
yeah.
on the foundation that those really exist. The love of the Universal Father is based upon the Justice Administration of the Paradise Trinity.
Absolutely, yes.
You know, and so, you know, it's one of the most important aspects of the Fifth Epical Revelation, because it's caused no end of confusion and, you know, and great tangential problems to the point of global emergency, right, that this foundational fact has been lost. And so enough said about that, but that other issue that on the surface seems to be synonymous, docility, and you notice as they said, reputed.
Yeah.
Okay. Again, he's not a pacifist. Okay. But most importantly, right, is to not just, you know, interpret that word on its surface, right? The word docile means that you're teachable, literally. The literalness of the word docile means teachable. You know, we kind of get at that, you know, when you imagine these youths attacking Jesus and saying, I'm going to teach you a lesson. See? You know, that expression, I'm going to teach you a lesson. See, Yeah, that's that teachable, docile. But, you know, again, so on the one hand, you have him not manifesting, you know, literally it's not in his biologic temperament, you know, even before it's part of his will, you know, not manifesting justice administration, but he's also an individual that is, quote-unquote, coincidentally, teachable, right? Docile, teachable, right? So it's so important. If you're going to be someone who is going to, you know, begin to mature the way Jesus is maturing, you have to be teachable. And so, you know, they're just pointing out, you know, it's built in. Now, one other fun little tidbit that's in this paragraph. We have that word uncouth. The revelators in various places, you know, utilize that word. What does it mean literally? Uncouth means unknown, literally. It's like, unknown? Why? Well, you know, think about it. You're a tribe of people, and you come upon this other tribe, and you go, and you watch their ways, and you go, wow, the ways of these strangers are unknown to us. Okay? You know, their folk ways are unknown to us. Okay, so you have that kind of immediacy, but remember, you know, all these tribes are religious in one way or another, right? It's only today that we've got this, you know, this dark secularism.
Right.
And so, you know, when you're thinking those ways, those folk ways are unknown to you, they're uncouth, you know, your ways, you believe, are the ways of your God, the God of your tribe. You know, and so, you know, you're also kind of between the lines thinking that the ways of these strangers are unknown to your God. And it's that sense that you want to keep in mind everywhere where the revelators use uncouth. Right? These uncouth use, in other words, I never knew you. There we are again with Matthew, seventh chapter of Matthew. I'm crying, Lord, Lord, I never knew you. See, the revelators, you know, are making that point. Like, for instance, you know, you see it very overtly when they talk about an ungodly and uncouth assembly. Right? Bidirectional. They don't know God, and God doesn't know them. Right? And so, you know, you've got, you know, it's actually a very stark thing to be indicating that you've got use that God can't see. Those use might want to think about doing something about that. Because if God can't see you, if you're not known, if you're unknown to God, you don't want to get it into that past tense, I never knew you.
Yeah. Well, of course, in Jesus' day, there would have been plenty of people roaming around without thought adjusters. They weren't universally bestowed. So maybe these uncouth youths just weren't of the thought adjuster ilk of that, you know, spiritual age.
Yeah, but, you know, to not, you know, but, you know, just to recognize that, you know, now that everyone has thought adjusters, it's like, well, okay, so that doesn't apply to us now.
No, that's not true. You can still turn away from God even with an adjuster, yeah.
Right. Again, it's like I was saying earlier, the difference between fact and truth. Right? I mean, you know, the most important basis for understanding this revelation is the truth of what's being said, not some factual parsing of it. And so, to be, if you are uncouth, if you are unknown to God, well, then there's just that impersonal paradise trinity, because of which you will always suffer swift and certain retribution. See, notice how it's important to kind of plumb the depths of literalness of docile and uncouth, to fully appreciate the artistry that the midwayers are using in this paragraph.
Yeah.
Those are not two words. I had actually highlighted a couple of words in our reading tonight. I'm like, well, we need to make sure we know these definitions. Look at Brad. Look at the clever guy. But I missed uncouth. I'm like, I know what that means. I had no idea. Docile. I was sure I knew what that meant. Puppy dog eyes. No, that's submissive. that's not the same.
Yeah, it's like, no, he's reputably teachable. Oh, I'm going to go teach him a lesson.
Show him. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So anyway, it's just very interesting that, we've got this factory story about Jacob the Stone's Mason's son. It's just very illuminating to see that this pairing between the Father and the Paradise Trinity, they're being revealed. That pairing is being revealed together, not just the Father. Like I said, it's like that's some interesting supremacy. There just happens to be this neighbor boy with fists of steel.
Fascinating. Jesus was the generally accepted leader of the Nazareth lads who stood for the higher ideals of their day and generation. He was really loved by his youthful associates, not only because he was fair, but also because he possessed a rare and understanding sympathy that betokened love and bordered on discreet compassion.
Yeah, so here we are, 10-year-old Jesus, basically. And already, his sympathy in his lower domain of his mind isn't mere sympathy. It's already a sympathy that's beginning to manifest under the shadow of the upper domain, love and compassion. Right? You don't have, betokened love, okay, bordered on, discreet compassion, okay. It's just the beginnings of a shadow of the upper domain being a predicate for sympathy below. But nonetheless, it's there. Right. More, he's already becoming a top-down functioning being instead of just a bottom-up welling phenomenon.
Yeah, definitely see that. The word I highlighted in this paragraph, because I know exactly where I defined it in my own life, is discreet. My definition comes from age 8 watching the movie Ghostbusters, where the Ghostbusters were ironically referred to as being, quote, totally discreet in their way of dealing with problems. And, of course, they come in with guns blazing, and it's a huge mess. So my working definition for discreet, I got the irony, but I just assumed that meant quiet and not noticed. And I'm like, this paragraph makes no sense. So I finally looked it up, but I had to use an old dictionary and a new dictionary. Like the older definitions are about character. The newer ones are about, sort of performative things to avoid embarrassment. You've got to have the proper definition of this word.
Yeah, and again, it's just, you've got a number of words that branch off from that basic foundational word of discern, right, to separate apart. You know, so you have this spelling of discrete, you have the other spelling of discrete. You have discriminate. Right? I mean, you know, you could say bordered on discriminating the compassion.
Right.
You know, in other words, it's not this indiscriminate phenomenon that we've talked about that's on the bumper sticker, random acts of kindness. It's discriminating, right? Because if it isn't discrete compassion, it's going to end up fostering evil rather than goodness in its lack of insight and discernment. So, right, I mean, it's interesting to notice, see, that... they added that modifier to compassion,
mm-hmm.
to remind you that you're getting the precision of the upper domain, not just, let's put sympathy on steroids, and just let it be some gushy, oozy, honey, sappy, quote-unquote, compassion. No. It's discriminating. It's precise.
Yeah.
And he's already getting that precision. Now, we've talked about how much he's been fostering the development of his first cosmic intuition, his logical acumen, his ability to bring the upper domain to a point focus. And so, yeah, discrete compassion.
Yeah. I've got it on the screen here. I've got to read this. Here's the 100-year-old definition of discrete: possessed of discernment, especially in avoiding error or evil, and in the adaptation of means to ends, prudent, sagacious, judicious, not rash or heedless. These are all, higher things versus, a common definition today is exercising caution to avoid embarrassment, quiet, diplomatic, like political, I might add. Our language has evolved a lot in the last 100 years, reflecting the times that we live in. Diplomatic versus sagacious, there's a world of difference between those two.
Yeah, and again, all you see, when you go back to an older dictionary, or if you get a newer dictionary that's better, and it'll show you, antiquated or obsolete, sense.
Right.
No,
right.
I mean, it's just getting to the literalness of the word.
Right.
And again,
this is not that.
You don't need
yeah.
an old dictionary to understand the revelation. You need to know the etymology of the words. You need to know the logic of the truth of the word. The revelators are first and foremost not using the senses in any dictionary. They're using the etymology of the word. And so that silly notion that, if you go back to an older dictionary, you can find a definition that works better. No, you don't have to go back to an older dictionary. Just use the etymology. Use the logic of the truth of the word.
Hmm.
And then, you're talking about modern corruption. Because as science is getting more and more corrupted, etymology is a science.
Right.
And so more and more... You'll find some so-called etymology of a word, and it's not science; it's scientific dictation. It's someone just declaring that this is the literalness of the word. It's like, no, it's not. So, you have to overcome all of these hurdles to get to truth. And there were fewer hurdles to overcome like this. Some of these basic issues, 100, 150 years ago. But now everything is becoming corrupted.
Mm-hmm.
So just very important to appreciate you have to read this revelation challenging yourself as aggressively as possible.
One quick commentary in this paragraph that's somewhat inspirational in Jewish culture here is when they state that Jesus is the generally accepted leader of the Nazareth lads who stood for the higher ideals of their day and generation. Chris has often talked about this significance of this spirit nucleus and this predicate of turning, rooting yourself in eternity, and to think that there are these lads in this culture who are standing in a context where they're able to recognize the higher ideals of their day and generation as children. What a culture! What a wonderful place and time.
Yeah, those higher ideals, are the exception, not the rule. And so much of the world, not especially now, but even back then, right? Material gravity doesn't take you to the higher ideals. It takes you to the lower ones.
Yes.
And if you aren't aggressively challenging to overcome that natural flattening of your mind, you would have listened to this natural leader, Jesus of Nazareth, and rolled your eyes.
Yeah.
It reminds me of that passage of less than 1% regarding leaders. Yeah.
Yeah. Again, he can manifest, but if you don't have eyes to see, you will not follow. And Jesus pointed that out. It's like, my sheep know me and they follow me. It's like, well, didn't you come to rescue all the lost sheep? Well, yes, technically. But I can't get someone to see if they've closed their eyes.
That's their choice. Yeah.
Now, he came to save the salvable. He can't save the unsalvable. He can't save someone that God can't see. He can't save the uncouth.
The uncouth. All right.
Yeah.
Well, David, would you like to take the reading from here?
Yes, and we're at this year he began?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. This year he began to show a marked preference for the company of older persons. He delighted in taking over things cultural, educational, social, economic, political, and religious with older minds. And his depth of reasoning and keenness of observation so charmed his adult associates that they were always more than willing to visit with him. Until he became responsible for the support of the home, his parents were constantly seeking to influence him to associate with those of his own age, or more nearly his age, rather than with older and better informed individuals for whom he evinced such a preference.
Yeah, he's already conquering himself out of his animal origin nature, that evinced word there. He's already discovered how delightful it is to use your mind when it is being more and more dominated by the upper domain. He can't get enough of it. He wants to find a setting where you can't interplay without using your upper domain. Right? He's looking for adult associates, right? Who at least have some semblance of human framing of their minds. Right? There's an ability to discriminate issues out of the fog of confusion and whatnot. And he seeks that out. It's so delightful to be able to use that human mind. You get a very positive feedback from it. And I was like, oh, that's cool, thinking like that. I want to do that some more. Well, I can't do it with the kids in the sandbox. You know, they're just making truck sounds and pushing things around. You know, truck sounds were fun when, you know, when you were two. Yeah, and the issue with his parents constantly seeking to influence him, we'll get back to that in a little bit here. They give us some more info on the on what's going on there in Nazareth.
Late this year, he had a fishing experience of 2 months with his uncle on the Sea of Galilee, and he was very successful. Before attaining manhood, he had become an expert fisherman.
Yeah, we've addressed this, you know, where they occasionally punctuate the story with, you know, and he sought to master everything he engaged.
Right.
And that's why they called him master.
It's always been curious to me that in modern times, someone who shows that tendency is called a Renaissance man. I've never figured out why we colloquially do that. I don't know. But
in other words, someone that more resembles a human than a blob of protoplasm.
There we go. Yeah. Someone who's being born again.
Born again.
Born again,
right.
Yeah.
Right. So, yes.
If everyone could just put their blob of protoplasm T-shirts on, this would be a lot easier to distinguish.
Well, you know, I mean, people are getting you hardly need them to, you know, to stamp it on their forehead anymore. It's getting pretty obvious for a lot of them.
His physical development continued. He was an advanced and privileged pupil at school. He got along fairly well at home with his younger brothers and sisters, having the advantage of being 3 1/2 years older than the oldest of the other children. He was well thought of in Nazareth, except by the parents of some of the duller children, who often spoke of Jesus as being too pert, as lacking in proper humility and youthful reserve. He manifested a growing tendency to direct the play activities of his youthful associates into more serious and thoughtful channels. He was a born teacher and simply could not refrain from so functioning, even when supposedly engaged in play.
Leader, born teacher. So this children should be seen and not heard. He's too pert, lacking in proper humility and youthful reserve. You see, poor Mary and Joseph, you know, they have to live in Nazareth. They have to try to somehow, you know, have some peace, some, you know, in the neighborhood. You know, and so, you know, it's this issue, right, that's kind of immediately obviously behind them constantly seeking to influence him to associate with those of his own age, right, or more nearly his age. Because, Jesus, it's already so difficult to manage the parents of the duller children as it is.
You know, it's fascinating the way they phrase that when they state, except by the parents of some of the duller children who often spoke of Jesus as being too pert. It normally you think of the phrasing as, you know, there's a implied a direct quality of intelligence from the child up to the parent in this situation, instead of usually the apple is not falling far from the tree, right? So it's interesting that they flip that around. And then in section one, I believe, when they referenced the backwards pupil, so you've got these two sections back to back where the backwards pupil discovered Jesus drawing the charcoal picture, and then here they have the parents of the duller children. And when you think about pert being assured and youthful reserve, you don't show your feelings. From the vantage point of the parents of the duller children, humility is sort of inappropriately interpreted to be someone who lacks assurance and suppresses their feelings. And when you move towards that sort of animal level of consciousness, the budding stages of genuine human personality management that augment cosmic growth appear to be the type of character that's lacking in virtue. So things get flipped around 180 degrees.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's just, you see this, anyone who kind of follows the news, and some meathead kid, gets in trouble, and do the parents, immediately properly discipline the child? No, they immediately, go to law in defense of their meathead child.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is just, it's a very unfortunate, knee-jerk instinct. When you broke that some generations back, it's very difficult to get this proper relationship between parents and children back again. At the point now, we all know there's lots of parents who want to be best buds with their kids.
Yeah.
Of
course, at 12 years old, you could divorce your parents even.
Right. You get all of these very broken, societal phenomena happening. But anyway, but that whole bit of, them trying to keep Jesus under the radar of all these neighbors that are, constantly, gawking and, and gossiping.
Yeah.
He's got Mrs. Kravitz next door.
Yeah.
Little reference.
By the way,
Bewitched.
Pert was another word I highlighted because my definition comes from the shampoo. I mean, I'm just hopeless. I had to spend time on this one.
I believe that's Pert Plus, Brad.
With conditioner. I mean, I don't know what this word means. But it's the same root as the word as aperture. It's about openness. Yeah, I'm like, okay, there's something to work on. All right.
Like I said, when in doubt, start with the etymology.
Yeah.
Joseph early began to instruct Jesus in the diverse means of gaining a livelihood, explaining the advantages of agriculture over industry and trade. Galilee was a more beautiful and prosperous district than Judea, and it cost only about one-fourth as much to live there as in Jerusalem and Judea. It was a province of agriculture, villages, and thriving industrial cities, containing more than 200 towns of over 5,000 population, and 30 of over 15,000.
Now, what's the deal with this place that is more beautiful and prosperous, and it costs only one-fourth to live there? What's going on with that?
Yeah, this can't stand. We need some overlords to fix this problem. So notice, that you, when you bring in all kinds of dogmatic clamping down on a society, there's these unfortunate consequences. It costs more and more to survive. They have arbitrary edicts that don't allow humans to more naturally synchronize with their environment and lessen the difficulties of life. Mm-hmm. All the again, between the lines there, there's a whole saga of what's going on today. That's one of the reasons why they bring that up. Just turn it from ecclesiastical totalitarianism to secular totalitarianism, and you're in play today.
Yeah.
This whole issue of Joseph encouraging Jesus to, begin to think about the practical foundations of life. that you you know, you can't just let your budding religious consciousness, you know, float you up, you know, into you know, impractical visionary thinking. You know, so Joseph supplying this grounding influence. Again, you know, all, you know, just ask yourself, you know, independent of the specifics, you know, why did the midwares include a paragraph like this? And, you know, and seek for, you know, one of those fundamental principles that's in play. There's often many, but, you know, see if you can, you know, at least recognize one of the, you know, the fundamental principles and the truths that flow through those principles that's in play in a particular paragraph. So, you know, you can answer, why did they include this detail?
Can anything
but, you know,
good
Brad,
come out of
Brad
Nazareth?
Brad mentioned before about the 200 towns of over 5,000. You know, I don't know, was that a couple shows ago or so?
Yeah.
And I imagine, yeah, there's 30 over 15,000. So, you know, just in Galilee, you've got a very significant population. Yeah, and so just filing that in the back of your mind, when you get forward to the public ministry and you think about, you know, the small handfuls of people, you know, especially after Jesus, you know, disappoints them, not being all about free food and free healthcare, you know, what a tiny fraction of the population of even Galilee are attracted to him.
Mm-hmm.
You got a lot of people. Okay. You know, you don't want to think of it, well, you know, there's just a couple of visitors, so probably only about 600 people in the whole area. It's like, no. There's thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of people. And most of them, you know, could care less that an incarnate Creator Son is walking in their midst.
This seems to be a pattern that epical revelation follows, kind of across all of them.
Yeah, and how many people are on the planet right now? And it's accessible through the internet, but then, you know, is the world been turned upside down by the fifth epical revelation of truth to mankind?
There's no free food or health care in it. Something of the opposite. A lot of prescriptions against that, so that's not going to go over well.
Not to mention, you know, it's you know, Chris says you got to be interested in the etymology of words. Like, who cares? It's speaking to such a limited audience, right? You know, in terms of it being, you know, finding, you know, genuine but open living religionists, you know, who are hungry for truth and want to become religionists of philosophic attainment.
Yeah, but unlike, you know, there have always been great works of literature that are obscure or obtuse. You know, Plato's Republic is only read by a hundredth of 1% of any population in a given generation, but it's hard to read. The difference is, like, the Urantia book, yes, it has its difficult sections, but it's accessible to anyone who, I mean, you do have to be literate, and you do need, you know, roughly a college-level vocabulary to make good sense of it, but it's not impenetrable the way other arcane works are. It is accessible, if you will pick it up, but if you will.
I can't get over the fact that, like, everything I'm about to say and think and do has already been anticipated in the simulator. I'm trying to constantly trip him up. Did you get that one? Was that one that came out? Oh, that's funny. When on his first trip with his father to observe the fishing industry on the Lake of Galilee, Jesus had just about made up his mind to become a fisherman. But close association with his father's vocation later on influenced him to become a carpenter. While still later, a combination of influences led him to the final choice of becoming a religious teacher of the New World Order. New Order. I apologize.
You've been programmed. Okay.
I'm Freudian slip there.
Well, it's my fault. I'm talking about all of these overlords and stuff. But the immediacy of responding to his father's counseling to have a foundation under his feet, right? But evolving through the options, and and eventually, right, this fact that he's a natural leader and a born teacher, right? I mean that comes to the fore, and again, just think about it in supremacy, right? Coincidentally, someone who's going to be an ethical revelation biologically was a natural leader and a born teacher. Yeah. Coincidentally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not so coincidentally, obviously.
But cool. Until then, still fully human. I mean, there are lots of little boys and girls who want to be a potter. I want to be a fireman. I want to be a fisherman. I want to be a carpenter. Like you're trying on these different vocational attitudes toward the world, and that's perfectly reasonable as you're growing up.
Yep. And you should. Right? And to look to you, those immediately around you. You know, his uncles, right? Obviously, a big influence here with agriculture and fishing. And of course, his dad was carpentry. But again, he's this very dynamic individual, right? That doesn't top out in one of those immediate obvious ends, right? But uses them as scaffolding to work his way up towards God.
And to sort of play off of this destiny sort of concept, or you could kind of bring in supremacy or the simulator concept that David just touched upon. In 122, when Gabriel appears to Elizabeth, he's literally saying, "I, Gabriel, have come to announce that you will shortly bear a son who shall be the forerunner of this divine teacher, and you shall call your son John." So talk about things happening ahead of time, things being projected. It's quite fascinating. And this is a normal human. This is not the Creator Son incarnate. This is John. His name is being communicated in a dream.
Yeah, and so you've got, on the one hand, you have this direct interventionary issues, but don't lose sight of you have just as much, perhaps more, that's just baked into the fact that we're all parts in the whole.
Yes.
Right, and there are no coincidences in the fullness of the whole. There are no coincidences in supremacy. No parts are somehow independent of the whole. Therefore, there are no coincidences in supremacy.
Three, the 11th year, AD 5. Throughout this year, the lad continued to make trips away from home with his father. But he also frequently visited his uncle's farm and occasionally went over to Magdala to engage in fishing with the uncle who made his headquarters near that city.
But wait a minute. Deja vu all over again. Yeah, they basically say this at the beginning of every year. Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just notice that. So it'd be one thing to have them mention it one time, but to repeat it repeatedly, it is obviously they want you to think about how important it is, to have these foundational influences, these exhibitions of foundational loyalties that you can build upon, that you can reflect upon and select among. And everyone knows that mentoring is very important to development.
Makes you wonder what his uncles would be doing in nowadays.
But anyway, we could obviously vamp on that, for a long time. But I just want to make sure. It's like, you're not confused. No, they have said exactly that.
Multiple
before.
Times.
They keep repeating this almost verbatim, right?
Joseph and Mary were often tempted to show some special favoritism for Jesus, or otherwise to betray their knowledge that he was a child of promise, a son of destiny. But both of his parents were extraordinarily wise and sagacious in all these matters. The few times they did in any manner exhibit any preference for him, even in the slightest degree, the lad was quick to refuse all such special consideration.
Wow.
There's a little vignette that could be very useful in our current world, where everyone is clamoring.
Mm-hmm.
this
takes
me back.
I don't know if I shared this.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to say, I don't know if I've ever said this on Symmetry of Soul, but I've got a special name for my incessant clamoring. Every time I catch myself really trying to grasp for some recognition and honor, I just tell myself, no, there, Sessie the Clam. It's my little special name that I've given to myself that's always trying to get the extra advantage or the attaboy. So it tempers me. It makes me realize, oh, yeah, a little bit of humility is need here. Dave, let's get on it.
It's interesting to me that in section two, we're in paragraph five, when they referenced that he was really loved by his youthful associates, not only because he was fair, but then they expand upon that. And here they're giving you an example of the few times they did in any manner exhibit any preference for him, even in the slightest degree, the lad was quick to refuse all such special considerations.
Yeah, that he was able to detect it.
Yeah. Yeah, he was fair at the core.
Yeah, and again, you can just the way the midwares present this little vignette, you get the sense that you have his biologic temperament. Yes, but there's beginning to be more and more of a discriminating mind that's going, that's a very positive trait. I'm going to willfully foster that forward. That's not as great as a biologic trait. I'm going to work on minimizing that. Right? You get the sense that he's starting to have. The lad was quick to refuse all such special consideration. That he's getting more and more on top of himself and being discriminating and fostering when he should and minimizing when he should.
And they're describing that as rare, too, because he possessed a rare and understanding sympathy. Yeah.
Yeah, of course. Right. And, of course, Brad would be very disappointed if I didn't mention that we have the word sagacious here.
Sagacious, you say? What does that mean, Chris?
Right. I mean, but, here it's notice it's so immediate, When the revelers say wise and sagacious, it's like, wait a minute, I thought those were synonyms. Right? I remember the first time I read that and went, I thought those were synonyms, And so then you have to start reflecting. It's like, oh, I get it. It's wisdom, insight, foresight, and here you have it. Wisdom's first, right? The insight and the foresight. That's what's being bottled up in the sagacious. So the word sagacious, it often implies wisdom, but the revelators are pointing you know, but don't judge, you know, judge the book by its cover. I mean, what it's pointing to is having more and more of a transcendent of wisdom itself predicate, right? That insight and foresight more and more as a an influential predicate for the wisdom. So in other words, it's, you know, the wisdom is less and less canned and adopted. Right? I can quote every passage in the book of Proverbs. But more and more it's an originative wisdom, right, that you are generating yourself rather than just parroting and conforming to. Right, so that's the point of sagacious, that it has depth, you know, that merely the word wisdom doesn't have.
So would the word sagacious be like on the fourth and the fifth level of the hourglass meaning analogy?
Well, just think of it as, you know, it's just that insight on all levels, you know, the wholeness of the upper domain, just, you know, that there is, there is individual insight and foresight very consciously in play that produces wisdom. So sagacity implies wisdom, right? You know, but wisdom doesn't necessarily imply, you know,
Insight,
it's manifestation, and someone doesn't apply that they originated that. You know, it could be just enculturated.
Very true. Yeah.
Right. See, and again, notice it's sagacious is the foundational word. See, so it's top down. Right? And so, his parents have it. Right. And so, biologically, and nurture wise. They got Jesus off to a great start on this, and he's beginning to take the ball and play with it himself.
I like that he has such a sense of balance and symmetry that it uses the words even in the slightest degree. Like, he's capable of sensing even the slightest imbalance.
Yeah, right, again, that's that discriminating. Right, that's that upper domain ability to differentiate very subtle, fine points, right, that the lower domain can't. Lower domain blurs it all together.
I already feel at this age he's far surpassed me.
I'm blathering on and on and on here. We should probably keep reading if we want to finish this section.
Jesus spent considerable time at the caravan supply shop, and by conversing with the travelers from all parts of the world, he acquired a store of information about international affairs that was amazing considering his age. This was the last year in which he enjoyed much free play and youthful joyousness. From this time on, difficulties and responsibilities rapidly multiplied in the life of this youth.
So it's going to be handy that he has all of this upper domain stability and, you know, and activity coming into play early on.
Yeah.
Going to need it.
Justin, did you want to take over reading?
Sure thing. Thanks, David. On Wednesday evening, June 24, AD 5, Jude was born. Complications attended the birth of this, the seventh child. Mary was so very ill for several weeks that Joseph remained at home. Jesus was very much occupied with errands for his father and with many duties occasioned by his mother's serious illness. Never again did this youth find it possible to return to the childlike attitude of his earlier years. From the time of his mother's illness, just before he was 11 years old, he was compelled to assume the responsibilities of the firstborn son and to do all this one or two full years before these burdens should normally have fallen on his shoulders.
So just, you know, kind of keep this in mind. It's easy to forget this incident, and just think, well, Jesus had to kind of really step it up when his dad died. No, it was here. He was already having to take on their roles here.
Yeah. You know, I know it's a matter it's a matter of deep speculation, but, you know, Jude was not like the rest of the kids, and his birth was not like the rest of the kids. Mary was very sick. I wonder if there was some linkage between those things. Like, you know, they say the early home environment is important. Well, what about the very early baby environment? I mean, maybe he was just struggling a little bit, and that set up some tensions in his mind and body that persisted in his life.
Yeah, see, it's entirely possible, yeah. Now, that's an obvious, you know, potential speculation in this context. Oh, it's not just any old kid, it's Jude.
The kid ends up in jail.
The fact that he was born on, we know what day of the week he was born on, Wednesday.
Unlucky, yeah.
It sounds like, you know, very, pretty close to losing Mary there.
Yeah, yeah.
The Shazan spent one evening each work with Jesus, helping him to master the Hebrew scriptures. He was greatly interested in the progress of his promising pupil. Therefore, was he willing to assist him in many ways. This Jewish pedagogue exerted a great influence upon this growing mind, but he was never able to comprehend why Jesus was so indifferent to all his suggestions regarding the prospects of going to Jerusalem to continue his education under the learned rabbis.
It's like, well, teacher, the reason is probably because the midwayers called you a pedagogue instead of a teacher. Right? We have this singular usage of pedagogue here. Yeah, in other words, there was just, you know, he was a great teacher, but very circumscribed in dogma. You know, and even at this young age, Jesus is already recognizing that, Jesus recognized he has his sights set on something that can't fit in that small of a concept frame. A religionist will fit in that pedagogue frame, but not a religionist to philosophic attainment.
Yeah, that's very much the case.
Yeah.
But you can't expect the pedagogue to see that, and you can't hold
no.
that against them. They're only
no.
seeing the world from that circumscribed view. Yeah.
About the middle of May, the lad accompanied his father on a business trip to Skytopolis, the chief Greek city of the Decapolis, the ancient Hebrew city of Bethshean. On the way, Joseph recounted much of the olden history of King Saul, the Philistines, and the subsequent events of Israel's turbulent history. Jesus was tremendously impressed with the clean appearance and well-ordered arrangement of this so-called heathen city. He marveled at the open-air theater and admired the beautiful marble temple dedicated to the worship of the heathen gods. Joseph was much perturbed by the lad's enthusiasm and sought to counteract these favorable impressions by extolling the beauty and grandeur of the Jewish temple at Jerusalem. Jesus had often gazed curiously upon this magnificent Greek city from the hill of Nazareth and had many times inquired about its extensive public works and ornate buildings. But his father had always sought to avoid answering these questions. Now they were face to face with the beauties of this Gentile city, and Joseph could not gracefully ignore Jesus' inquiries.
The obvious thing that stands out is, you know, so-called heathen and quote-unquote heathen. In other words, the Jews can quibble about the degree of goodness in play, you know, in the Greek culture, but what about beauty and truth? Right? They're pointing out that, you know, yes, you know, there might be goodness issues, but, you know, the heathen label, you know, would indicate the absence of all three, beauty, truth, and goodness.
That's a good point.
And, you know, the recognition of beauty and truth was, you know, what the Greeks picked up during this spiritual quickening of the 6th century BC.
Yes. It so
it's
happens.
Not,
that
it's not that Jewish villages would have been filthy and disordered. They weren't the polar opposite. This just must have been an exemplar of particular orderliness and cleanliness.
The word ornate too. The ornate building.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
And again, it was just the sophisticated stone, majesty, stonework majesty.
Right.
It so happened that just at this time, the annual competitive games and public demonstrations of physical prowess between the Greek cities of the Decapolis were in progress at the Cytopolis Amphitheater. And Jesus was insistent that his father take him to see the games. And he was so insistent that Joseph hesitated to deny him. The boy was thrilled with the games and entered most heartily into the spirit of the demonstrations of physical development and athletic skill. Joseph was inexpressibly shocked to observe his son's enthusiasm as he beheld these exhibitions of heathen vangloriousness. After the games were finished, Joseph received the surprise of his life when he heard Jesus express his approval of them and suggest that it would be good for the young men of Nazareth if they could be thus benefited by wholesome outdoor physical activities. Joseph talked earnestly and long with Jesus concerning the evil nature of such practices, but he well knew that the lad was unconvinced.
Yes, it all gets very dicey, because of the second commandment, and the sort of the extrapolations from that, with the graven images. But just one little, little technical note. If people are curious about, ancient Skytopolis, note that this is happening, in the Roman amphitheater there in Skytopolis, not the Roman theater. Now, you often see pictures of the Roman theater there, but not there. It's the Roman amphitheater that was there in Skytopolis.
The only time Jesus ever saw his father angry with him was that night in their room at the inn when, in the course of their discussions, the boy so far forgot the trends of Jewish thought as to suggest that they go back home and work for the building of an amphitheater at Nazareth. When Joseph heard his firstborn son express such un-Jewish sentiments, he forgot his usual calm demeanor and, seizing Jesus by the shoulders, angrily exclaimed, "My son, never again let me hear you give utterances to such an evil thought as long as you live." Jesus was startled by his father's display of emotions. He had never before been made to feel the personal sting of his father's indignation and was astonished and shocked beyond expression. He only replied, "Very well, my father, it shall be so." And never again did the boy even in the slightest manner allude to the games and other athletic activities of the Greeks as long as his father lived.
Again, just like the, like I mentioned, we had the graven image thing before, and, here we see him again, having to make a very significant adaptation, to conform with the culture he was born into.
This reminds me really briefly of the religious guardians and the angels of progress, and Joseph as the parent is taking on this religious consciousness where he's conserving the ideals of what is and what has been. And Jesus as the child is taking on this sort of spiritual conscious mode where he's focused on that which ought to be. And it's fascinating to see that play out in this this incident.
Yeah, and again, for that culture, Joseph is correct. I mean, you don't have religionists of philosophic attainment. You just have, solid beginning religionists. And, they're going to lose that faint flicker of faith if you expose it to too much, secondary complexity.
Which is why
they can't assimilate, in a philosophic frame.
Which is why the religious guardians always checkmate.
Yeah. Yeah, so You know, obviously Jesus is working on the philosophic attainment that can, you know, manage more than one thing at a time.
Later on, Jesus saw the Greek amphitheater at Jerusalem and learned how hateful such things were from the Jewish point of view. Nevertheless, throughout his life, he endeavored to introduce the idea of wholesome recreation into his personal plans, and as far as Jewish practice would permit, into the later program of regular activities for his 12 apostles.
So again, you see, he was conforming, you know, in his outer life, but he didn't consent to the rejection of beauty and truth in the inner life.
At the end of this 11th year, Jesus was a vigorous, well-developed, moderately humorous, and fairly lighthearted youth. But from this year on, he was more and more given to peculiar seasons of profound meditation and serious contemplation. He was much given to thinking about how he was to carry out his obligations to his family and at the same time be obedient to the call of his mission to the world. Already, he had conceived that his ministry was not to be limited to the betterment of the Jewish people.
All the more reason to have the philosophic attainment. And, you know, here we see an important transition. You know, it is getting to time for him to start to take God very seriously. And when you do that, initially, you know, it gets overplayed a little bit. You know, like I said, if that goes too long, you become a humorless moralist.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But, you know, there needs to be some serious tempering of any frivolousness in regard to God. Now, you need to take God very, very, very seriously. All right? Yeah, man, you can take with a grain of salt. But, you know, it's an important step, you know, to kind of get that soberness and then work on with the philosophic attainment, you know, finding some humor and lightheartedness again.
Yeah, we don't have time to get into it. I just begin to wonder, you know, we certainly know after Jesus' baptism, we cannot rely on this narrative as any kind of a direct guide for our own lives, our own families. But you begin to wonder with the dawning of this consciousness in Jesus, you know, how much is he already beginning? Will he start diverging from, you know, the path? I mean, up until now, you can see a portrait of a pretty, of a great, just a successful boy. And there's a lot to admire here, but I don't know. It feels like the stage is setting for things to change.
Yeah, but again, you know, by and large, every one of us who is going to eventually be a first circler has to go through this same path.
Yes.
I mean, eventually you will hear a voice effectively saying it's time to be about your Father's business, even if it isn't a brilliant evening star saying it.
That's very true, and that's where we will have to leave it. Fine study. Thank you, everyone, for being here. As a reminder, we will be off for the next 2 weeks here on the Tuesday evening broadcast, but our Friday podcast is still going on, carrying on apace. We'll see you back here in a couple of weeks. Spend some time in the Cemetery of Soul Archive. Listen to some old episodes. Until then, do your best to follow the way. God bless.
God bless, everybody. Thank you for tuning in.
Take care, everyone.
Yes, take care, everyone. Remember that answer to that riddle. It is truth. And that is what we seek as we study this revelation. Peace upon everyone.